Taxi was canceled by ABC. That is the American Broadcasting Company. ABC. I mean, we didn't get our final bow. I mean, we filmed our last show this year on March 5th, and we didn't know it was our last show. It was devastating. You find out you're canceled, you don't get the final bow. Well, tonight, thanks to my comedy brothers and sisters here at Saturday Night Live, yes? That's right. I am going to bring out the cast of Taxi for their final bow.
Hey, Ron Odes and Russ Odes. That's right. No matter which direction the polarity of your charge is going, you are listening to All You Ever Think About Is Sparks, the only and therefore best podcast devoted to the music of Ron and Russell Male, a.k.a. Sparks. This is episode 35. We had so much material for you, including a really, really long intro that I had written, but I'm setting that aside and I'm having to cut this wonderful but monstrous conversation that Monty Mallon and I had about Angst in My Pants. We're going to have to set some of that aside. I'm going to try to make this a really quick turnaround to get you the second part of that. But for today, you're just going to have to sit back and enjoy what we have before you today. So may we start?
When I first started driving, cabbies who wanted to put a little kink into their evening would line up at a juice bar where they gave secanals along with the Tropicana. The hope was that some Queens cutie would be just messed up enough to make the trade. But the girl usually wound up passing out somewhere around Francis Lewis Boulevard, and the driver would have to wake her parents up to get the fare. Those words were written by former cab driver Mark Jacobson in a long-form two-parter titled Night Shifting for the Hip Fleet for New York Magazine in 1975. In the piece, Jacobson takes us on a few ride-alongs with various cab drivers, a motley group whose only shared commonality was a fleet headquarters in Greenwich Village called Dover Garage No. 2, sometimes known as the Hippie Garage. Jacobson describes many of the cabbies, their backgrounds, their motivations, their aspirations. He recounts, quote, a college professor, a couple of PhD candidates, a former priest, a calligrapher, a guy who drives to pay his family's land taxes in Vermont, a Romanian discotheque DJ, plenty of MAs. It was an intriguing piece. 1970s New York City was a capitalist fever dream, a glittery smear on the cosmic celluloid of human history, a time and a place where sleaze, violence, and despair mingled freely with glamour, fame, and art, giving way to a chaotic froth of a most romantic flavor of mortal threat. If Erwin Schrödinger ever co-owned a tenement building with Freud, it would have been like most of New York at that time. Behind each door was either sex or death, and sometimes both. Television writers James L. Brooks and David Davis were fascinated with the article, and they thought, and probably, workplace sitcom. Of course, a workplace sitcom was what they were used to writing. When their then-current project, The Mary Tyler Moore Show, wrapped production in 1977, they sought to create a similarly relatable, but darker, show with a dingy New York cab station as the primary set piece. Taxi debuted on the ABC network on September 12, 1978. It boasted an unusually talented ensemble of players, some of whom, like Judd Hirsch, had misgivings about doing television at all,
let alone a prime-time sitcom. The characters were archetypes rarely employed for comedic scripts in those days. You had a washed-up casualty of 60s drug counterculture, a divorced mom of two trying to make it in the art world, a gambling addict in recovery, small-time boxer, a small-time actor, a bewildered immigrant, a lascivious crook for a boss, openly and proudly given over to the dark side. Misfits, the lot of them, each cash-strapped and lovelorn. Almost immediately, Taxi was a runaway success with critics and ultimately earned scores of Emmy Awards, Golden Globes, and others. To this day, Taxi rarely fails to make the lists of greatest TV comedies of all time. But the show was never a ratings juggernaut, and ABC made little effort to promote it. The network changed its time slot several times and eventually canceled it after its fourth season. In fact, ABC nixed the show just days after the final episode of the season was shot. Creator James L. Brooks received the news on May 4. In a meeting with ABC executives, he described to the Washington Post as, quote, horrible. I brought up quality at one point, said Brooks in a Washington Post article dated May 13 of 1982. And one executive made the kind of gesture that says, how do you talk to somebody who uses words like that? Quality. The history of network television has shown without a peep of a doubt that the word quality carries less weight at ABC than it does at NBC or CBS. By 1982, cable was challenging the three commercial networks for viewers, and rather than lean into prestige programs like Taxi and the similarly gritty police station comedy Barney Miller, ABC gave these shows the axe and threw their lot in with fluffier fare with broader appeal like Three's Company, Joni Loves Chachi, and The Love Boat. It's gotta get a rating in that slot, Brooks said in that Washington Post article. And as opposed as I am to saying bad things about other shows, what you have there is an hour of women who have big breasts. It's that kind of continuity of programming that governs ABC. Someone once wrote that the Beatles had taken pop and turned it into art. And then MTV came along and turned it right back into pop. A TV analog might be MASH turned television into art, and The Love Boat turned it back into living room furniture. Executives at ABC looked at their bottom line in 1982 and decided to place their chips on boobs, sight gags, and magic powers. They aimed for the young, mostly male demographic. And the other two of the big three networks? CBS had carved out its niche as the preferred network for older adults and would later double down on this approach. However, CBS was still number one in the Nielsen ratings in 1982 with seven primetime shows in the top 10. NBC, comparatively, was in a dismal state. Other than the progressive police drama Hill Street Blues, NBC wasn't cracking the top 20 at all. Even its flagship late-night sketch comedy show Saturday Night Live was suffering following the departure of showrunner Lorne Michaels in 1980. Sensing an urgent need for a change in direction, NBC hired 32-year-old Brandon Tartikoff in 1981 as their new president of entertainment. Tartikoff would eventually lead the network to dominance throughout much of the 1980s and well into the 90s. When news of Taxi's cancellation by ABC hit, NBC soon entered an unexpected bidding war with cable upstart HBO to pick up the series for more episodes. With its deeper pockets and a much vaster reach, NBC prevailed, and Tartikoff celebrated the acquisition in the news media thusly. By picking up the most acclaimed comedy on television, we feel we're sending out a signal that we're interested in quality, Tartikoff was quoted saying in a New York Times article dated May 22, 1982. We just finished our affiliates meeting, and we got a strong vote of confidence for that kind of programming. So instead of Taxi wrapping production abruptly, without warning, and without a chance for the writers and performers to say goodbye on their own terms, Taxi fans would not have to suffer from narratio interruptus. Although the fifth season would be its last, and the final episode still hardly functions to this day as any kind of coherent finale, Taxi's showrunners at least got to produce 24 more episodes, which put them over the then threshold for syndication, 100 episodes. But why was NBC so quick to rescue Taxi from the pop culture graveyard? Great shows end up on the bubble all the time and then pop without warning. Rugs get pulled out from under producers' feet constantly. See Twin Peaks, Star Trek the Original Series. The span of time between the Washington Post's article announcing Taxi's cancellation, it's May 13, 1982, and the New York Times article announcing NBC's acquisition of Taxi, May 22, is a mere 9 days. Does anything work that fast in the entertainment industry? What happened? No direct causality is being asserted here, but the timing is too interesting to disregard. On the night of May 15, 1982, Saturday Night Live broadcast the penultimate episode of its 1981-82 season. While SNL's seventh season didn't come close to reaching the heights of its popularity or quality during the initial Lorne Michaels-produced run, 1975 to 1980, the seventh season was a better written, better performed, and better received season than the desultory sixth season, which nearly led to the Comedy Institution's cancellation in 1981. The death blow was almost struck when ABC's copycat show Fridays started to overtake the NBC flagship comedy in the ratings. But like its parent network, NBC, SNL righted its ship and eventually dominated over its competitors. Meanwhile, the show Fridays entered a sudden and steep ratings decline, which led to its own demise just a month before SNL's May 15, 1982 episode. Danny DeVito was the guest host on SNL on May 15. One could imagine that if DeVito guested on a late-night sketch comedy show the previous year, it would have likely been Friday, since both that show and DeVito's show Taxi were both on ABC, and the cross-promotion would have been prudent for ABC to push on to DeVito. But by May 15, 1982, there was no Fridays, and suddenly for DeVito, there was no more Taxi. Like show creator James L. Brooks, DeVito was shocked. And then, livid. Unlike Brooks, DeVito got to vent his spleen about it on live television on another network. Reading aloud a, presumably fake, letter from his immigrant mother, he proclaimed on TV, in her voice, "May God forgive them," that's ABC, "but of course, we will understand if he does not." A mere 2 days after the Washington Post reported on ABC's kibosh on Taxi, one of that sitcom's biggest stars, Danny DeVito, ripped into ABC, and he got to do so straight into the camera, bringing along all of his co-stars to share the final bow that ABC had deprived them of. Andy Kaufman was one of the Taxi co-stars present, sporting a neck brace that supposedly was the result of his much-publicized match with professional wrestler Jerry Lawler. Viewers who remembered Kaufman's absurdist performance piece from SNL back in 1975, when he lip-synced the theme to the Mighty Mouse cartoon show, could be reminded not only of SNL's glory days, but of the kinds of chances NBC was comfortable taking when it looked like something edgy and intriguing was happening. If you were watching SNL that night in 1982 as a fan of Taxi, you might have ended up thinking NBC wouldn't have canceled Taxi. Look, they're too hip. Later in the show, in a filmed sketch that would likely never make it to air if done today, the familiar opening sequence to Taxi plays, famous theme song and all, but it segues into Danny DeVito acting out a revenge fantasy by driving a taxi right up to ABC headquarters with a bomb and blowing the place to smithereens. Side note here, Peacock, that's NBC's streaming channel, they edit the scene out of the official version that's available for streaming. Now, did Danny DeVito's very public vituperations against a corporate rival influence NBC and Brandon Tartikoff specifically to acquire the production rights to Taxi away from the very mean and dumb ABC, who wouldn't know quality if it bit them in the ABC Monday Night movie? Someone out there maybe knows the full answer, perhaps even Danny himself. But setting aside the fate of Taxi for a second, DeVito is clearly enjoying himself in this episode of Saturday Night Live. He helps elevate an otherwise so-so episode to something more vibrant. Since NBC and producer of SNL, Dick Ebersol, pretty much gave DeVito free rein to do as he pleased, you can see him clearly basking in the freedom, embracing the absurd, indulging his fancy, you know, just doing his thing. And not in a destructive way either, like Andy Kaufman when he refused to deliver his lines to fellow actors in a contentious episode of Fridays, but instead in a way that welcomes you in as an audience. But I know what you want to hear about. What about that episode's musical guest? Some 20 minutes or so into the episode, Danny DeVito appears on stage next to Ron Mail, introducing him as Ronald Mail of Sparks, with a few words about his first song. Ron, wearing a white button-up and red tie, addresses the camera to impart some fun facts about mice in the matter-of-fact delivery of the host of a nature documentary. Danny remains at Ron's side, mugging or making a mouse face to punctuate Ron's more salient points about his favorite genus of the Muridae family, the mouse. Watching closely, one may get the impression that Danny's presence next to Ron helped calm the latter's nerves, as it had to have occurred to Ron that he had never directly addressed around 10 million people, give or take, at once before. And definitely not beginning with a line like, "The mouse is a member of the rodent family, distinguished from the rat in that it is smaller in size." Another sidebar here. Given how famously litigious Disney is, have their lawyers ever harassed Sparks about the song Mickey Mouse? Especially right here, where Ron talks about lab rats being pumped full of saccharin right before transitioning into his closing statement mentioning Mickey? I don't know. From the top of the performance, Ron's keyboard pierces through the rest of the instruments, and you can see him turn down the volume on his Ronald-branded Roland after a weird chipmunk voice intones the words, "Mickey Mouse," underneath Russell at the song's first chorus, followed by a what-the-hell hand gesture from Ron to who knows. Okay, so Ron apparently wasn't too happy with the weird verbal outburst seemingly coming from his keyboard. I mean, was it his keyboard? Was it a sampler in 1982? I'm not sure about that one. You could see he was irked by questionable sound mixing at the outset of the song played live as well, but the band quickly recovers and finds its footing after several seconds. The energy is spot on, though, from everyone, and the band looks great throughout. Green glitter suit for hyperkinetic Russ, matching purple glitter suits for the rest of the band, sans David Kendrick. Bonus points for Ron taking center stage a second time during the song's middle eight as he unveils his inimitable Ronald Shuffle on national television and even tries his hand at a few breakdancing moves. No, it isn't a flawless performance of Mickey Mouse, but Sparks sticks the landing just fine. And fitting for a comedy show, Ron and Russ joyfully play up their stage personas for extra laughs. Much, much later in the show, there is a lengthy interview segment between Brian Doyle Murray and Andy Kaufman, who relays his Jerry Lawler episode with video inserts of the infamous wrestling match. All done with a straight face, by the way. And right after that, a short, frankly dismal sketch about an interview with the author of a fake book starts and then ends, paving the way for musical performance number two. "And now," announces Danny DeVito, with just minutes left to go until the goodbye waves from the cast to the audience commence, "my good friends, Sparks!" And you can absolutely buy the notion of Danny DeVito considering these musicians to be, quote, good friends. Not only does the band come out swinging for I Predict, but the generous wide shot at the start of the clip shows Danny DeVito on an adjacent stage, twisting and stomping away with abandon to the song's bruising opening riff. When the camera pulls in closer to the band, Russ is grooving in a similar manner to Danny, but in a much more controlled fashion. It looks like no one in the band felt like changing outfits between songs, except for Ron here, who sports a fishing hat this time, a collared pullover, and his Argyle dad pants. I Predict goes off without any noticeable hitches, and the band is in fine form throughout the duration, even if Ron's Roland just doesn't seem to make the same sounding patches as the ones that you hear on the album. Right after Sparks' second and final performance, the cast and the band all gather on the main stage together to bid farewell to the audience. The cast of Taxi has also returned, and Danny DeVito delivers a final surprise to the audience by introducing his real-life mother, immigrant mother, onto the stage to immense cheers. In the back row, someone helpfully boosts Ron up a few feet into the air so he can get a quick look at all the hubbub. Danny's elderly Italian mother takes the final moments of the show to curse that evil American broadcasting company once more, in her native Italian tongue this time.
Now Mom, is there anything you want to say more to ABC?
Yeah. Mannaggia reale per te. Ma su ABC sono giudice e stupid.
One week after the airing of that episode of Saturday Night Live, the New York Times publishes Brandon Tartikoff's announcement that the beloved show Taxi would find a new home at NBC for the upcoming 1982-1983 season. For their part, Sparks would be back on tour somewhere between Philadelphia and Roslyn, New York, by the publishing date of that article, and with 13 more show dates across North America to go. Now for the part where I try to tie all these threads together in some meaningful way. Venturing across the usual free resources on the web hasn't brought me really any closer to the big questions I had for this segment, namely, was Danny DeVito a Sparks fan? Followed by, did Danny DeVito lobby to get Sparks to join as musical guest on the same episode of SNL as him? If anyone has answers to any of these questions, please feel free to email me at podcastsparks@gmail.com. What I have unearthed, meager as it is, isn't completely nothing. Rude Swart, in his Sparks Albums project, mentions that DeVito had, quote, apparently attended some of their concerts before. And another online source that I'm sorry I just can't seem to find again mentions that Danny visited Ron and Russell Mayall multiple times the week leading up to the live SNL taping, either in their dressing room, at NBC, at their hotel, or both. If so, those dates do check out, as Sparks apparently played no shows between Palo Alto, California on May 8th and Cleveland, Ohio on May 17th. Although it may be common practice for NBC to ask their musical guests to stick around for the whole week leading up to the performance. Okay, so even if I've vastly overplayed a hypothetical Danny DeVito Sparks alliance, and even if the very notion of Danny was so inspired by Ron and Russ's take no orders, give no fucks attitude, he threw off his shackles and told ABC to suck it on live television, if that's all just the stuff of breathless fanboy projection, and it might be, a show like Taxi and a band like Sparks deserve to share some stage time together. Who couldn't imagine a Ron-penned song about a button-down blue blood who eats one laced brownie and becomes a shattered wreck of a man for the rest of his life? They call me the Reverend, but I never learned why. I left the head of J.P. Morgan on hold to take a bite of a chocolate pie. I don't know. But how about an unusually short dude who grows cynical and becomes a cab dispatcher? And why? because he hangs his life on the hope that one day he'll dispatch the right cab to the right place, and it'll be the home of that girl who's he's been obsessed with ever since they met once in a coffee shop, but the phone number and address she wrote on that napkin got destroyed before he could get a good look at it. How about a song actually called Womp That Sucker, about Tony Danza's hard luck boxer character, or My Island Sank, a mournful ode to Laka Gravis's fictional home country. Or, you know, you could take the whole thing from another direction. Couldn't you imagine hearing the lyrics from Amateur Hour over a montage of Latka's fumbling efforts to land a lady in New York City? The upshot of all this is that Taxi follows the very weird but weirdly relatable trials and tribulations of a group of eternal misfits. And that could also describe the protagonists of scores of songs written by Ron and sometimes Russell Mail. In 1982, one of the greatest, oddest situational comedies ever aired was set to be canceled by people with power and money who didn't get it. But the show instead earned a stay of execution from someone else who did. That'd be NBC or Brandon Tartikoff. Facing professional oblivion was the sort of near-death experience Sparks had endured and survived numerous times by 1982. But when they got to play Mickey Mouse, and I predict, on the most popular late-night sketch comedy show in the U.S., Sparks could finally boast of getting a toehold in their home country. In their past, all the people with the money and the power didn't get it when it came to Sparks. But now, they could hopefully say that somebody finally did. Cue Andy Kaufman as Latka Gravis saying,
"Thank you very much."
Oh, wait, I almost forgot. Sparks also had some beef with ABC. You see, it was ABC that wanted to make a series about famous comic book heroine assassin lady Modesty Blaise. You Sparks fans, I'm sure, know a little bit about that story, know who Modesty Blaise is, and the song Modesty Plays that Sparks ended up releasing. Well, the original recording of Modesty Plays, at first titled Modesty Blaise, was supposed to be the theme song for that series. But after the pilot aired, presumably with the theme song by Sparks there, ABC dropped the idea and did not pursue Modesty Blaise. I can only hope that Ron and Russell got paid by ABC. Otherwise, screw them.
And now, Once again, my good friends, Sparks! Yeah!
So here we have it. We are finally getting to angst and my pants. So the last moment, chronologically, that we left was Sparks doing that weird one-off show somewhere in Germany on TV that I think was the first anniversary of the murder of John Lennon, and just a very strange show, a weird way to end a mini tour.
Is that where where Ron played the banana?
That's where Ron played the banana.
Absolutely. Okay.
Good memory. Yeah. And so not too long after that, they retired back to Musicland Studios. Let me pull up my notes here. Musicland Studios in late 1981. And they started rehearsing a spate of new songs that Ron had written in the hotel above the studio there. And these recordings were completed really quickly. They had 6 weeks. They did it all within 6 weeks. I guess it's not super fast, but it was released on Atlantic Records. RCA did not option for another Sparks album, which was interesting. But Atlantic picked them right up. They released the album on March 29th, 1982. That was the swiftest follow-up to an album in Sparks history. The Womp to Angst.
Is it? Because Didn't Propaganda come out just months after?
Oh, my God. That's right. Oh, this can't be right. That's got to be bad information. No, you're absolutely right there.
We will double check on that.
During the recordings, and this is from Rudd, the band occasionally played a handful of rehearsal gigs at small nightclubs in Munich, but those were not advertised, and very few local fans were aware of that. Can you imagine being one of those lucky people?
Be great.
Out of all those songs that they recorded, at least one of those songs, Sherlock Holmes, was written before the sessions for that album. They initially called it Midnight Rodeo. It had completely different lyrics. Angst in My Pants, the title track, and the first track on the album, that was actually the last one to be recorded. It was on the very, very last day that they had the studio. And it other than a drum loop from David, it's all Ron doing all the parts on there, all the synth and whatnot.
Yeah, which is amazing when you listen to it. It's amazing that that would be the last one they'd record in a day.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, the album title.
Yeah, it was so, and it's so iconic. It's such an iconic part of their category.
Yeah, it is, and of course, you know, it's been featured in many things in media since then. That we'll get
commercials have been using it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Very true.
So they had to get this done really fast because they had booked three double gigs at the Whiskey A Go-Go for late January. So they had to get the hell out of there. This is the way Ron described the new album in a Sparks newsletter around that time. Maybe some of the poppy buoyancy of Womp That Sucker Is Gone replaced by a heavier beat and slightly darker mood. This is 1982, after all. What do you think about that? Do you think
I read that comment and I was thinking it's different. It's definitely different. It's a little bit more mature, I guess, in some ways in the production.
Yeah.
But I don't see it as having all that dark a mood. I guess this is where we need Paul Barrett, I guess, because I don't see it. So that was my reaction to Ron's comments. And I've thought about it. What do you think?
I agree. Yeah, actually, when I think about Womp, you know, we talked about Russ being this this master of ceremonies and, you know, unveiling all these little playlets, these telling these very bizarre little stories, most of them about women.
Wacky women.
Yeah, wacky women. and I guess as a whole, you can come away feeling like it feels like a some sort of a weird sci-fi B movie. I think there are a lot of, because of the subject matter on some of the songs on that album, you know, it's just a little spacey. It's a little weird. I think things, subject matter wise on this album are a little more, closer to home. Literally in that fact, LA is all over the place.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. I would agree with that. And, you know, I think we talked about this a little bit, like some of these songs, like Mickey Mouse, there seems to be an underlying context about what they're saying there. A few of the others, you can hear that as well. So I can hear that.
Yeah.
I didn't want to interrupt you, though.
I'm not sure where I was going with that.
Okay. Well, so, yeah, no, what I was going to say is, here's what I hear is the difference in my mind, is that after Number One in Heaven and then Terminal Jive, Womp That Sucker was, this is the word I would use, fresh.
Yeah.
It was fresh. It was not a derivative of Terminal Jive. It wasn't in that mode. It was fresh. This one doesn't have that freshness. It has built on the first record, which is different. And to me, that's how I hear it. I hear it as a step forward in the same vein. Whereas Terminal Jive, I mean, I'm going back to when I was listening to these things for the first time. Terminal Jive was, we talked about this, is wow, this is fresh. It's new. It's great. It's a revelation. This is good old Terminal school Jive, spark.
You mean the sound of Terminal Jive?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm talking about Womp. I apologize.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Womp. I apologize. Yeah. when this one came out, I was like, okay, they built on the first, on that last record. They took it a step further. The band is tighter. We'll get into all of this. But that's the word that I would hear. I come back to in my mind as I thought about it, fresh, you know, whereas this one is mature.
So I started thinking about it today like this. With Womp, they had assembled the ingredients, but they were still trying to figure out the recipe. And I think they perfected it with Angst or something close to it.
Yeah, no, I know what you're saying.
Get the same players, the same band. You've got basically all the same instruments. Recorded at the same place. I think Womp was a learning experience for all of them with this new setup. And, you know, when you introduce the variable like inspiration, you never know. But Ron sure does seem more inspired on this album. They all do than they did on the last one. Womp, you know, is a really fun album. And but it does kind of, once you hear Angst, it does kind of sound like a dry run to me.
Mm-hmm.
For Angst.
I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying, but I still feel that Womp is really special because it brings all that humor. It brings that freshness. It has that guitar. Well, until just a couple years ago, I was an Angst guy. So it's right up there. I just kind of leaned toward Womp a little bit because there's zero songs I have any problems with whatsoever, whereas there's one or two here that I'm less crazy about. That's it. That's my whole standard, which is a stupid standard. But it's my standard. So, you know, but I can't tell you how much I love this album. And this was the first time I saw them, and I was just so happy. I was with Rob Seeger, who's Joe's husband, and my friend Jamie Demarest. And we saw them in Cleveland, and I pulled up the set list for when you want to talk about that. And, you know, this album has so much meaning to me, and the songs are so good. So I don't even want to get into a comparison thing. I love them both. They're two of my top tens.
Yeah. It's always been in my top three, this album. And that's one of the reasons why I was hesitating to do this particular episode, because this album, I come back to it every time, and it always hits me in the right spot, which is not always true for every single Sparks album. This one does do that. You had Mac again, of course, Reinhold Mac, just to go through a couple of these technical things real quickly. You hear, whenever you hear a keyboard, you're hearing Ron playing his Roland, rebranded Ronald, Jupiter 8. So that's his instrument the whole time. And I don't think, we talked to Jim Goodwin, great guy, a couple of episodes back, and you will see his face, on the back cover of that album, but I don't know if he's actually playing any keyboards. There he is. If he's playing any keyboards on here, or if it's all just Ron.
Well, that's a great point, because I was thinking about that. Another difference might be that he wasn't playing on the first one. He toured with them, but he didn't play. So is he playing, and is he bringing something to the party?
You think that would have come up in our conversation with him?
Yeah, he kind of indicated he didn't really play much on the records.
I'm going to go through a few more of these. Yeah. I'm going to go through a few more of these little notes real quickly. First, Atlantic Records was actually pretty vigorous in promoting the album, much more so than RCA. They ran full page ads and a bunch of various music papers, the LA Times. This asterisk here, I suppose, but this was Sparks' second ever top 100 album in the US. It charted at 173 on the Billboard 200. Can you guess what Sparks' first ever top 100 album was in the US?
Well, I know the very first album had a single that actually Wonder Girl.
That's true. No, that's I don't know if that lines up with the top 100 album. I think actually Womp made it. But you're absolutely right about that. Let's see, which one was it? I predict that actually climbed up to number 60 or something in the Billboard Hot 100 charts, and it was the highest that they had charted since Wonder Girl some 11 years before.
That's crazy.
I know. Isn't that crazy?
That's so crazy.
And all these people hearing these songs for the first time think, oh, these are these guys that had that album that came out last year, and they're, you know, this brand new act. And
a phenomenon that exists to this very day.
To this very day. The album Art, it's one of my favorite album covers of all of Sparks' stuff. You got Larry Vigan again, I think that's his name. He was the guy who was the designer of the album sleeve for Womp, and he came back again. This was an idea that Ron had, showing Ron and Russ as a just married couple, kind of poking fun at the fact that apparently no one ever saw Ron and Russ apart from each other, like a married couple. And there it is.
Yeah, they are.
But the back cover, as you showed us a little bit before, does show the entire band. It's the first time they had done that on a record since 1975, I believe.
Yeah, that would be Indiscreet.
Indiscreet. Yep. I think that was the last time they did that. By the way, that image of them on the back of that album, that sleeve there, isn't that are they making fun of an Elvis? That's an Elvis pose, right?
I guess a little bit, yeah. It's just like an all-purpose rock and roll guy.
Yeah, I suppose so. let's see, the singles that were released, I Predict was released. We'll talk about that a little bit more in a bit. And of course, we talk about the Wonder Girl thing. There was a, they only had one video from that album, and that was I Predict. We won't talk about it now, but I'm sure we will. By the way,
we
have to talk about it. It was not directed by David Lynch.
I'm just going to say directed by David Lynch, of course.
Not directed by, there it is. So I'm not sure exactly here. So, I've got several different sources.
And the last one on Womp That Sucker was directed by Sam Peckinpah.
Yeah, well, I think that's what I told you.
I think so.
Yeah, I don't know if that's true.
I don't believe either.
That's what I told you.
Yeah.
So the music video for I Predict, it was directed, most of my sources say it was by a guy named Douglas Brian Martin. But the cinematography was done by a Frederick Elmes. And Elmes was David Lynch's director of photography at that time, which probably led to the legend that that Lynch did create it. Other than that, Eaten by the Monster of Love was released as a single only in the US. Angst in My Pants was released only in Germany. And then you've got the lesser known Modesty Plays, I suppose, that was released only in Germany. And of course, that did not make the album. And it showed up later. And there was not a single, but there's a video of the song Mustache floating about that I'm sure most hardcore Sparks fans have seen. And that is what inspired me to make my own Mustache video, by the way, when I showed up.
You're now infamous. You'll have to include a link to that.
I will. I guarantee. All right. So, Angst in My Pants.
Angst in My Pants.
What do I want to say before we really get started with the song? So I'm going to let you go first.
No, what I was going to do is just mention, I thought at some point it'd be interesting to hear the song list from the show that I saw at the Agora, if you're interested in that.
Yeah.
Because what's so interesting about it is I couldn't find that one specifically, but I found like a typical song list from that period. And it's literally all this album and Womp That Sucker. When I saw them, I remember them doing BC and maybe Amateur Hour. I don't remember that they did a whole lot. I haven't been able to find the song list, but it's very interesting that they really focused on their American albums when they did this live.
So I read a little bit about that too. Yeah. Their American fans were just simply not aware of their long history of being a band. And the only music, the only songs that had any traction with them, with American fans at that time, were the songs from Womp and Angst, which is interesting. Yeah. And much to David Kendricks's chagrin, because when they started doing shows promoting the album, he kept wanting to play old stuff. He's like, play Equator, play Talent as an Asset. And nobody knew it.
Mm-hmm. They didn't know it, or they didn't want to do it. I mean, ultimately it's up to Ron and Russell.
True. Yeah. But I think they were playing to the crowd, and the crowd just weren't, you know, they just weren't familiar with the classics, with the old stuff.
And with Ron doing a striptease and Russell coming out in that outfit that he was wearing, I think there was enough shock value in the show anyway. And who is this weird guy behind the keyboards? So
yeah, exactly.
Maybe they figured at least give them something they may have heard.
Yeah, exactly. What do you think about? I'm not sure what to get into before getting into the songs precisely, but the sound of the album. I guess I want to get into a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, this is more your bailiwick, but I will say that you made me more aware of listening for that particular aspect. I think it's a little bit tighter, a little bit more developed than it was the first time. Mm-hmm. I think the production issues are better. I would say maybe a little bit inconsistent in places, but overall, I'd say that it was a step up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's weird, man.
Right?
What's that?
Same producer, same band. So, they were been playing for a year and a half or so together.
Yeah, they still have the Mac is back. They've got Reinhold Mac. These two albums, and I'm not sure if it's just the quality of the recordings that I have, if it's on the discs that I have or whatever, but the production, or rather, I guess, just, whatever the released output was for those two albums, the production always seemed just not quite right. Just like not crisp enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's your experience.
Do you think that is part of why on the next album they produced it themselves and started the trend toward being so completely self-contained that you have now?
That's a great thought. Yeah, maybe so. Yeah. Could very well be.
A couple albums later, they kind of lost that a little bit once they got into pulling rabbits out of my hat or whatever. Out of the hat. That's where hat. I think that that was a step backward, actually. So, but that's a discussion for a later day.
I will say that the sound of Angst in My Pants is very much of its time. In that it sounds like early 80s power pop in a lot of places, and new wave, and and some synth pop in some places, but it doesn't to me sound like it's too tethered to that time, which I don't think you can say for some of the albums that came out in its wake, like In Outer Space, which I like, but
yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I think that this
is... Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah. This is a rock album that doesn't... That you can listen to today in 2023 and it probably hits in pretty much the same way. Whereas, if you listen to In Outer Space, it sounds like 1983.
But, the whole production thing was such a weird aspect for them at this time, having gone from the studio thing with introducing to going to Giorgio Moroder, to going to Faltermeyer, to going to Mac. It was like they didn't have stability in working with someone who knew how to produce their sound and their vision. And because their sound and vision is so strong, they overcame all that. But, you know, I would think, you know, there is, we talked about this with Paul a little bit. There is a point where they got to be Sparks 2.0, where they were just like, we were in control of everything.
Right.
And at this point, they're still trying to be a rock band who sold a lot of records. So I think that they probably didn't have as much ability to say, okay, here's what we want. Here's what we want to make sure. This is who I want producing it. They probably just didn't have that kind of, you know, also they weren't selling a lot of records outside of anywhere, really. You know, they always had somewhere.
Right.
But, you know, they probably didn't have the ability to just say, here's what we want.
Yeah.
And I think that probably shows in some places.
Well, yeah, I think part of that was, you know, just not being as well known as they would have liked to, not having the resources that they would have liked to. But, you know, once it became feasible to build your own home studio for, you know, $10,000, I think changed everything for those guys.
I do too. I do too. And I've said this before. I said it with Paul. I'll say it again. At that point, in my humble opinion, they weren't trying to be visionaries. You know, I mean, there was a taste of that with Number One in Heaven, but they were trying to be guys who sold, got a band together and sold some records. And, yeah. You know, later in their career, they had a sense, this is what we want to do. This is how we want this to sound. They had the luxury to do that. At this point, I just do not think they had that luxury yet.
Right. And it was soon to come.
Yeah.
It didn't happen very soon.
Years off. Years off.
I had some like thematic ideas on the album and its songs as a whole, but I think I'm going to wait just a little bit until we get into some of the songs so that it sort of makes a little bit more sense. Because I do pick up on some kind of satire. well, specific satire, like things like consumerism, like conspicuous consumerism. That's all over the place here. And as we go through the songs, I'm going to try to point those out. But I see this as an album where it really does seem to be of a piece of the sort of Reagan, Thatcher era of just rank consumerism.
Yeah, they weren't all that crazy with that era. Yeah, I remember comments they made very, you know, they don't put much of themselves out there, but I remember every now and then there would be a little comment consistent with what you said.
So, you put the platter on for the first time, 33 RPM, and the first song is Angst in My Pants. Before we start on Angst in My Pants, I was going through looking at various ads that they had put out promoting the album.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like they're always trying to explain what the word angst meant. Was the word angst not like known, you know, by English speakers before 40 years ago?
I think it was known. I don't know. I think maybe it wasn't widely known. You know,
a sense of anxiety,
like,
I think.
Like gravitas.
Yeah. Okay.
That would be another word that people know, but maybe not widely. I don't know. But
Angst in My Pants. There it is. And so, what a title, right?
Oh yeah.
I mean, it's pretty squirmy. Angst in My Pants.
Angst in My Pants. And there's another interesting dimension to all this, which is this was a period where everybody was putting out 12-inch disco singles of their songs. And
still?
They did that. They did that. They were as consistent as anybody else. And the first thing that I heard was I Predict, because they put that out, and I could dig it up too, but they put that out as a single, and it came out a little bit, I believe, before the whole album. So my friends and I were just already bopping away to I Predict, looking forward to this album. But that's an interesting aspect that I hope we'll explore a little bit as we talk about all this, is the whole 12-inch thing. And I think they even put out an album compiling them.
Hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
Madeline Boccaro.
Yeah.
You know her. She has a fantastic blog.
Yeah.
She wrote
She's a fantastic writer.
Oh, yeah. She is. She wrote, after an intro that sounds like a steamship's horn, at the beginning of Angst in My Pants, you know that opening, the melody and instrumentation are simple and sparse yet beautiful. Who else would write such a happy-go-lucky song? I bet a certain gravity-defying male reflex which is just the best set of words I've read in a long time.
Yeah, she's good. She's good. She captures it better than anything I think I could say. But yeah, I just remember that we were really focusing, as I was listening to it, really focusing on the words, because the words were, you know, the one consistent thing with Ron's lyrics is that they can be very, very funny. And we talked about that ad nauseum over the last album, but this is a really funny song.
It is pretty funny. Yeah, but also what I get from it, and it, you know, it may be it's the chords used, you know, but it, there's a melancholiness to this song. Now, you know, Sparks, you know, were no strangers to songs. Ron Mayall was no stranger to songs about sexual frustration, a guy that just can't get any, and that's this particular character right here. But this particular song, it comes off more, a little more sad and with a little bit more resignation.
You think so?
I do. Yeah, I get that from that, and that's why I think it's an unusual beginning to the album for me, because it feels so melancholy to me.
I never heard the melancholy fact. Certainly, in some of the other songs, there's a touch of melancholy. But this one, I just thought it was kind of a funny little ditty that they put together with a funny little drum track and just had some fun with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you hear a little bit more to it.
Perhaps. Sure. Let's see here. So David Kendrick's drum loop, that's the only thing. This is in the key of D major. There are only four chords played. This was actually slapped together in a really short amount of time. The song itself. They had just a couple of days to go before Sparks had to leave the studio and head out to LA to do their shows at the Whiskey A Go-Go. So he just slapped together a few chords along with the lyrics that he wrote to make this happen in one day.
It's interesting that he did that, because there's six songs on the first side and five on the second.
Yeah.
So he didn't need to. So I guess something inspired him. Maybe somebody used the phrase and he decided, oh, that would be a funny little song. And he just put it together.
Well, what's interesting is I read that they had that title for the album the whole time. Mm-hmm. And they had an idea, you know, for a song. They just didn't have that song. And I guess just, you know, when Ron was looking at the clock and he's like, let's do the song. Here we go.
This is what we're always talking about. How can he write songs like this?
I know.
In minutes
I know.
Time? Yeah.
And that's also why, you know, as much as, and I don't mean to, you know, this is not a slight at Paul or anything. As much as I would love to believe that Ron and Russell constantly have some sort of an uber vision in their heads all the time throughout their entire career about all of their songs and albums and lyrics, you know, I think about things like this where, you know, where they had, you know, maybe 48 hours to get something done and recorded and put on tape. And there it is.
So since you mentioned Paul, we should probably come back to him for a minute. We should probably tip our hats to him and just say he was a great guest.
Oh, hell yeah.
He was so great to talk to. And he doesn't care if people disagree with him. He really has thought this out, and he's prepared to engage and go back and forth. But he doesn't care if he doesn't expect everybody to agree with him. But his commitment to his vision is unparalleled. And so I thought he was great. I thought it was just wonderful having him.
Oh, I totally agree.
Yeah. So just a little shout out to our friend, Paul.
Absolutely. Thank you, Paul. And you'll be hearing more from Paul very soon.
Yes, you will.
Here it is. Angst in My Pants. It's the first song on the album. I have the lyrics here. I'm going to read these, and then, you know, maybe you can read the next song's lyrics. We can get that pulled up, and here we go. This is Angst in My Pants. Oh, and by the way, I keep saying that. Russ has a, he's really moved away from his, like, all the time falsetto register.
Yes, he has. Yes, he
right
has.
Off the bat. I mean, you've heard his voice like this a few times in Womp, but he's really committing to the, I don't know if he's ever sung in a lower register than this up to this point.
No, it comes back in a couple of the songs on side B in a couple places. But yeah, no, he's going for the full throated rock star voice there.
No, I hope it doesn't show.
Still with all his wonderful nuance and phrasing and all the things that make him so great.
He is great. Thank you, Russ.
Thank you, Russ.
I hope he's listening. I hope it doesn't show. It'll go away. It's just a passing phase. It'll go away. You can dress nautical, learn to tie knots, take lots of Dramamine out on your yacht. But when you're all alone and nothing bites, you'll wish you stayed at home with someone nice. But when you think you made it disappear, it comes again. Hello, I'm here, and I've got angst in my pants. You can be smart as hell, know how to add, know how to figure things on yellow pads. Answer so no one knows what you just said, but when you're all alone, you in your head. What's the computer say? It's mumbling now. It says, hey, Joe, it spelled it out, and you've got angst in your pants. You've got angst in your pants. But when you think you've made it disappear, you're sure you've made it disappear, and you've still got angst in your pants. I hope it doesn't show. It'll go away. It's just a passing phase. It'll go away. I hope it doesn't show. It'll go away. Give it 100 years. It won't go away. And I've got angst in my pants. I've got angst in my pants. And then he repeats. And there it is.
Sounds like a solid set of lyrics from a guy who's written probably 150 songs by now.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, I'm going to stick with my original position on this. I hear what you're saying when I listen to the lyrics, but I think it was just something he wrote, and he just happens to be clever enough to be able to put together something like that in a very short period of time.
Well, it's a familiar sort of character that he's taking the perspective of, you know, the guy who just can't get the girls. What's a little bit more interesting to me about this one is that you kind of discern from the lyrics that, you know, this guy may be a rich guy. Maybe he really does have a yacht.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he's out there sailing, and you know, and he has he's done so well for himself materially, financially, but it's still not enough.
Well,
he can't get the ladies.
That was a theme he used later in Dick Around. That was a theme he used before a couple times. You know, that's one of his big themes.
Totally. Yeah. All right. Okay, everybody.
It's a great song. I mean, you know, I just want to preface all my comments with saying these are all great songs. There's a couple places where I'll mention that they don't work quite as well for me, but I mean, you know, it's angst in my pants. When they did the last tour in 2022, and I saw the set list that they did at the LA shows, the very first two, and I said, yeah, well, all right, there's all those great songs. That's all going to be cut back by the time they come here, but that's okay. Yeah, they didn't. And they did Angst in My Pants and, you know, Wonder Girl. Hearing Angst in My Pants was great. And Tips for Teens, you know, I didn't think I would ever hear them again. So there they go. I mean, these songs are enduring songs without question.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
All right. I've got Angst in My Pants. We're playing that song right now.
Hope it doesn't show, it'll go away. It's just a passing phase, it'll go away. You
Song two, I predict. You had the single.
I did. I had the 12-inch single. It was great, you know, and we just played it over and over and over. And here's where I think that, you know, consistent with what we were talking about at the beginning, here's where I think they start to have a little bit more of a texture and a couple of points that are hidden in the silliness. I mean, it's a silly, funny song, and the video was played all silly. That up. But, you know, there's, you know, they're starting to talk about the press a little bit and how the press reports things, you know, and
okay,
you know, that it's starting to get a little bit of a point hidden in the music, I think. Okay. At this point.
Yeah. So this is the distinction in my mind lyrically between this album and WAMP. It's more concerned. Well, it's more, I hate to say political, you know, more about the cultural, the political, socio-political state of society as it is now. And, you know, instead of in WAMP, I guess they, you know, preferred to
Martians and
there you
fashion
go.
Statements.
Exactly. And, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. There seems there's a bit more of a, you know, a culture, a satirical, a political message. There's a better word for it that it's just not coming to me, but it's a little more real. It's a little more.
Yeah. It's hidden though. It's hidden, but it's there.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not sure how deep WAMP ever particularly gets, you know, it's more like a funny story. Like you said, a television show, which I loved. But these have a point. These have, and a lot of these songs do have a point now that we're starting to really break them down a little bit.
I keep coming back to consumerism when I think about the songs on this album. And this is definitely one of those. And Russ said himself that this song was inspired by the National Enquirer. Okay, that's not a big stretch. And other tabloids like that. And where do you see tabloids like that. It's usually when you're in line at the supermarket or something like that. It's an aspect of our commerce, mm-hmm. you know, so to speak. Which I thought, you know, and there's a lot of that in this album.
Yeah.
Now the way that the song sounds, I thought that was, I'm not sure what they were going for here, but I mean, it was like they wanted their own big, dumb rock anthem that you might hear at a sporting event, like a Gary Glitter's Rock and Roll Part One or a We Will Rock.
Thank you, by the way, for putting that song in my head now.
Oh, yeah, you can't stop.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Hey, yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah. It was, you know, it was so over the top. The video is so over the top.
It
was almost got to the point of being a little difficult to watch. And I guess that's because it was produced from the David Lynch school, at least,
sure.
if not David Lynch. And, you know, it's a classic Spark song in that it really does, on the surface, it can be enjoyed just as a silly statement about those silly newspapers. But I agree with you. I think there's a little bit more to it, you know? And I think that carried through in a couple of the other songs, just like you said.
Yeah, well, I think there's more to it because there's two things. One, there's a critical eye towards this phenomenon of cheap and easy, whatever predictions. You know, whatever you call what it is you're looking for when you pick up a tabloid like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean it's so in your face, but then that was one of the ones that they did on SNL, right? And
yeah,
it was just a boom, overwhelming performance, and you know they just hit you with it, and it's 2.5 minutes, and it comes across, and you know they played up the silliness, but they played up when I saw them live. Oh, I should grab this. I still have Ron's tie. Well, no, I won't do that now. But for the next one, I still have Ron's tie because my friend got it at the Cleveland show and he gave it to me a few years ago. So I have Ron's tie. So they were still playing up that whole striptease thing. I guess maybe Ron was trying to figure out his additional shtick besides being Ron.
Was he trying to do a striptease, but like dressed as Ron, not dressed as whatever, like,
yes.
his female
yes.
character in the cabaret was?
Yeah, and you can see that in videos. And then he goes, when he gets to a certain point, and sits back down all proper. But yeah, he did it. And then when I saw them on the Two Hands, One Mouth tour, I brought that tie. I guess this was the second one. And I showed it to him, and he kind of gave a little smile. And I think he was wondering why I was showing it to him at the same time. And I thought afterwards, I wonder if I could get these guys to autograph it. But it didn't quite happen. But yeah, but I remember his look. He thought, "Do you want?" He looked at me. He was wondering. Oh, I remember that tie. That was great.
That's really
great
funny.
Moment.
Yeah. So the other half of what makes this song funny to me and interesting is that it is so aggressive, and that it is playing hard on those power chords and the very simple but loud sorts of beats. You know, again, that make you think of things like, you know, Gary Glitter or We Will Rock You. It's ludicrous.
It is. And, you know, I know one of the things that you like when we talk about is David Kendrick. And I won't do any 10-minute commentaries on David Kendrick this time. But this is the album. I think there's more of him on this album than on the last one. And
yeah.
I was thinking about this. I think also they realized what a gem they had. So they decided how to incorporate him a little bit more into the production. So I think here's an example. And the next one of where you really hear, well, I guess you could say the first one, but I think that was Ron just fooling around the studio. But on this one and the next one, you can really hear his playing in such a prominent way. And I think that was a very conscious decision that they made.
Really?
Yeah. Well, because it's not that he was doing anything that special on this song, but it's so good and it fits in so well with where Ron was going at the time in his music.
I was listening to this album nonstop over the weekend, of course, for this
recording, and there were so many times where I had to stop and rewind and you know, re-listen, because I'm starting to pick up on some of these drum patterns that Kendrick is doing that I hadn't really noticed before, and realizing just how much that guy's doing. And it's really impressive.
Mustache and The Decline and Fall of Me. Those, we'll talk about them later, but those are some serious.
I think I talked to him about that one.
Yeah,
that was it. Anyway, by the way, just shout out. I predict, by the way, the fluffy meringue on all that, the cowbell, fantastic. If you're gonna have just some big dumb rock song, and you bring out the cowbell, well, you've done it right.
You've done it right. Just ask. All right. Ask the Blue Oyster Cult.
Yeah. Are you thinking about a particular song?
Oh, yeah, Don't Fear the Reaper.
Oh, right. Okay.
Mountain Song, Mississippi, yes, Queen, course. Is that great? Right. Honky Tonk Women has a great use of the cowbell.
Yeah. Here I am. I totally forgot like where the whole cowbell craziness came from. Yeah. It was
right.
Right. So I have the lyrics in front of me for I Predict. Do you happen to have them up?
I have them right here. I have.
All right. Well, I'm going to pass this on to you.
All right. I have the lyric sheet for this album.
The lyric sheet. Oh, from the, the actual lyric.
This is the, it was part of the sleeve.
Hey, can we see that sleeve?
Yeah.
Did you want me to show us the sleeve?
It's torn, but I have it. No. This is the lyric side, but I think you're interested in the other side, right? Which is this amazing classic picture of them.
Oh, there it is.
Yep, there it is.
That's the Niagara Falls thing that I heard about but never saw because I never actually owned the LP.
You never saw it. There it is.
All right. Super cool. Great place.
There it is. Super cool. Absolutely.
Right.
All right. And the lyrics are, you're going to take a walk in the rain and you're going to get wet. I predict. I guess that's the point we need to bring out about the song, is these are not predictions that are going to knock anybody's socks off.
Right.
you're going to eat a bowl of chow mein and be hungry real soon. I predict. Are my sources correct?
Oh, my God. You got to stop for a second here. Okay. Sorry. I hate to interrupt you. But literally, this is the moment that I realized that the words were bowl of chow mein.
What did you think they were?
I thought it was a bowl of champagne. and then I started thinking, well, I guess that's just the way people refer to, you know, consuming champagne. When it's served to you in a bowl, you take it out and it's called eating a bowl of champagne. Chow-mein.
Is this literally the moment?
This is literally what I thought. This is literally the moment.
This is a breakthrough.
It is. It's a break. Yeah. It's a breakthrough for me. Yeah.
Well, and congratulations.
I could go for some chow mein. Yeah, here we go. All right.
Or for some champagne.
Or some champagne.
Where are we now?
And be hungry.
They're going to find the queen is a man, but that Philip don't care. A little dated. I predict. Yeah. They're going to, I said that one. Lassie will prove that Elvis and her had a fleeting affair. I predict. Now you're getting into the real tabloid stuff. Are my sources correct? Yes, I know they're correct. I predict. Then there's a little change in the music. Men, if you say your prayers, you'll never lose your hair. L.A. is safe. Ain't gonna quake, I predict.
Thank you.
That's all we have of Christian and Monty today. But do not fear, because the rest of that conversation is going to be headed to a podcatcher your way very soon. Dance, goddammit.